So I've titled the talk tonight, Views and Opinions. Do you have any? Views and opinions are something there's usually no shortage of. And ours are not always the same as our neighbors, or for that matter, our spouses, or our parents, or our friends. How do we relate to views and opinions? A Thai forest master, Ajahn Chah, said very simply that the greatest hindrance is views and opinions. Can't hear it?
No.
Isn't it pretty close to me?
No, it's not in front of your mouth. Yeah.
Feels like it's really close. You know, I'm going to take the opportunity to complain about this thing. I just spent 10 days fighting with this mic, and I'm still fighting with it. If anybody has technical background and has a little bit of interest in helping Tovana and having sympathy for the next teachers that come, please talk with the managers afterwards and get together. You know, every other place I teach, we have these little things, and they actually project, and there's, you know, people can actually hear, and I don't have to be, like, doing this thing. So maybe Tovana can improve if somebody puts forth the energy.
That's better now.
It's better? But it sounds better? Okay. Actually, I have a better view of my papers this way. Okay. From the Middle Eight Discourses. If a person has a belief, he preserves truth when he says, "My belief is thus." He does not yet come to the definite conclusion, "Only this is true, anything else is wrong." Beliefs do arise. We have them, we construct them. And the Buddhist teachings acknowledge and recognize that there are various views. This is a process that we have. We construct views. So we are not trying to put forth a right Buddhist view, a better Buddhist view. The Buddhist teachings ask us to consider instead, how do we relate to views? Do we solidify and grasp a hold of views as being correct, and therefore others are wrong? Do we think we're right? Just reflect for a moment. If sometime in the last few days you thought you were right about something. Okay, the last few minutes. At the time of the Buddha, there was a flourishing spiritual debate and a remarkable tolerance for different religious and ascetic views and practices. In ancient India, they had a culture that encouraged debate and dialogue. It was a dynamic spiritual community, an intellectual climate that was quite stimulating for the practitioners. And as practitioners of different sects and different orders and different approaches gathered in the parks outside the cities and met together, they would discuss their various approaches to the spiritual life. They would discuss their various beliefs. Now, sometimes arguments broke out. And we get a glimpse of what kinds of dialogues may have happened at the time of the Buddha by finding little snippets or little fragments of those dialogues recorded in the ancient texts. Now, of course, the religious record that we're using for the Buddhist tradition is the Pali Canon, which means that it was written from the perspective of one sect of Buddhists. So we're getting their views and their opinions. We're getting their perspective on things. But even so, it still gives us a very interesting glimpse into the the culture and the life and the needs and the minds of ancient Indians. There is one discourse in the Udana that says, wanderers of other sects are quarrelsome and argumentative, arguing the Dhamma is like this. No, the Dhamma is like that. No, the Dhamma is like this. No, the Dhamma is like that. No. Have you ever had an argument like that with somebody? Maybe not in those basic words, but one person saying something is this way and another person saying, no, it's like this. It's not. No, 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 no. Each person is attached to their own view. They don't see the whole. They don't see the experience from another's perspective. The simile that the Buddha gave of this argumentative spirit was like a king who had an elephant, and he gathered a group of blind men from his kingdom to approach the elephant, and he asked each one to go up to the elephant and to touch the elephant and then to describe that elephant. What was an elephant like? And so, of course, one approached the back end and touched the tail and said, an elephant is just like a broom. And another one touched the leg and said, no, an elephant is just like a stump, a trunk of a tree. And then another one touched the trunk of the elephant's trunk, the nose, and it said, no, an elephant is just like a hose. And then another one touched the edge of the ear. It said, no, an elephant is just like a thick sheet waving in the wind. They all had a different description of the elephant. And none of them saw the whole picture. None of them really knew what the elephant was. And then the Buddha said, some bhikkhus and Brahmins, so-called, are deeply attached to their own views. People who see only one side of things engage in quarrels and disputes. We all have opinions. Even the most spiritually awake people that I have met are conditioned by their culture, by their generation, by their education, their politics, the place that they grew up, their gender roles. We've all formed ways of doing things, things that seem right, that seem good, that seem correct, that seem efficient, and that seem fair. Often we don't even recognize these ways until we travel to another culture, and then we discover there are very different ways of doing things. Or perhaps we simply sleep overnight at a friend's house, and we discover that they wash their dishes in a different order. Or they put the little toilet paper roll going out this way instead of going under this way. I'm always amused when I come to these retreats in Israel. And I don't know what we're going to have for breakfast tomorrow because we have a different kitchen crew. But the last 10 days retreat, we had red capsicums, you know, those red bell peppers, at breakfast time. That seems normal to you, doesn't it? To have tahini and red capsicums? No, it doesn't. Well, it seems really, really weird to an American. Really weird. In fact, if we have them again, I'm going to run back and get my camera because my friends are not going to believe that oatmeal and red bell peppers can even go on the same table. We simply don't eat salad for breakfast. So different cultures have different ways of doing things, have different expectations. What seems normal, what seems right, what seems natural varies place to place. If you want to explore your own attachment to ways of doing things or views and opinions about how to do something right, then do sign up for the job of chopping vegetables, because there are lots of different ways to chop a vegetable. Now, I've also noticed that in Israel, you're a little bit more relaxed because I see that the carrots have a variety of ways of cutting them. And the You know, the onions come differently. Well, I practiced at other retreat centers in other places, and I was on one veggie chopping team where we were all assigned to our little station, right? Basically, the knife in front of the cutting board, and we'd stand there. And then placed in front of each cutting board is the example. And we're supposed to replicate the example. So if it's, if it's like, slice the cucumbers 2 millimeters thick at a slight angle of this direction, then you're supposed to do them that way. And the cooks come along and check. And if they're not quite right, they correct it and they ask you to do it the way that their example is, and they make another example and they show again how to do it. So there's a little bit more variety here, but the idea is that I'm trying to get across just is that there are different ways of doing things. Sometimes we think that our way of peeling an onion is the best and only way to peel an onion. And I started to collect different tips at one point as to how you can peel an onion so that you don't cry. Because for some reason, I often had that job, that yogi job of peeling onions, and then I would go into the meditation hall crying. And I really think every single cook has a different method for peeling an onion with the philosophy that it will prevent the crying. The funniest one, I don't know if you guys do this in Israel, but the funniest one was to peel the onion with a piece of bread sticking out of your mouth. And so the couple of us who were peeling onions were all given a piece of bread to hold. And then I think it may have been just so that we couldn't complain. I didn't think it worked, actually. But I had a whole list of different tricks for peeling onions. And each person seemed to think that that was the best way to do it. Our mind can rationalize some of our ways of doing things, some of our beliefs. We can develop explanations for them, and we can even have scientific evidence and statistics to bolster our views. But basically, when we're talking about a view, we're talking about a stance, a position that we have taken, a way of constructing a comfortable and familiar place for ourselves. A place we stand on that view. If we hold a view, then that viewpoint will be affecting our perception, and it will be inhibiting a clear, direct, and mindful perception of the experience, because we'll be experiencing something through the perspective of that view. Our views will distort what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, what we think about, how we feel about things. In order to learn, in order to grow, in order to perceive experience freshly, we must be willing to empty our minds of preconceived opinions. If you came here with expectations, please let them go. I guarantee I will disappoint you. Whatever the expectations are, we limit our experience if we impose our expectations onto the future. Do we really want to have the experience that we already conceived of, that we already thought about? Where's the fun in that? Where's the surprise? So whatever expectations you had, if you came expecting silence, you're going to be disappointed because there are going to be discussion sections. If you came here wanting an academic analysis of the discourses, you're going to be disappointed because there's going to be all that time wasted in meditation practice. Whatever the expectations are, let them go and open to the possibility of just being here moment by moment and see what unfolds from this interesting combination of Dharma study, reflection, and silence. The Buddha Dharma is not an anti-intellectual approach. Some schools of thought seem to emphasize the meditation beyond everything else so that we only sit. And some schools of thought emphasize the study and give very little time to the meditation. But what I'm encouraging here are days where we spend some time in reflection, some time in discussion, some time in listening to the discourses, some time in reading the discourses, and some time in silent sitting and walking, valuing each of those components of the Dhamma path. So the first step is to let go of expectations, let go of assumptions, let go of the preconceived opinions. The illustration is of a cup that's filled with dirty water. If your cup is filled with dirty water and you want fresh drinking water, the first thing you have to do is empty the cup. Let go. Start with release. Start with letting go. Whatever viewpoints we have, they might seem very real to us. But they're just a viewpoint. They're just a stance. There's no real reality to them. And they're probably not the same expectations that the person sitting next to you came with. They're probably not right. Imagine that there are two people and three buckets of water. One person has their hand in one bucket with hot water and their other hand in the bucket in the middle, which is warm water. Then the second person is standing next to them with one hand in that same bucket of warm water and another hand in a bucket of cold water. And they're asked to describe the temperature in that bucket that they have both their hands in. Is it hot? Or is it cold? And one person says it's hot and the other person says it's cold. And they genuinely experience it because they're experiencing it in relation to their other hand. We don't know what the experience is in another person. We don't know what they just came from, what they're struggling with. And yet often we have views and opinions about what somebody should do and how they should be. And yet we don't really know what their reality is. Each of our perspectives is going to affect how we interpret our perceptions. What do we base our opinions on? And when we offer our views or our opinions or our interpretations or even our advice to another person, what is that opinion based on? Does it have any significance or reality for that person? One of my teachers was offering a training for people who lead Dharma discussion groups and sitting groups. And at this training, he said something very simple. He said, "It is easy to be wrong about what others need." And I think we can remember that whenever we have a strong opinion about what somebody else should be like or what they should do. It is simply easy to be wrong about what others need. For a few moments now, I'd like you to reflect. Are there some views that you are currently holding? Views about your practice, perhaps. You have opinions about Vipassana practice in the West. You have views and opinions about your Sangha, your nation, your government, probably a few. Everybody has views about the government. Do you have views and opinions about somebody dear to you, your spouse, your parents, your sisters, your brothers, your work, your teachers, And perhaps most importantly, do you have opinions about yourself? You might actually jot some of these down. Maybe even after the session, you might want to write down a few of the opinions that seemed strong for you as you listened to the talk. And then examine them. You can ask two questions. Are they true? And can you actually know if that opinion is true? Look to see what your view has been based upon, what it reinforces, what it sustains within you, why it's a comfortable opinion for you to hold. What do you get out of holding that opinion? And then look to see if there is any contradictory evidence, any situation in which that view is obviously not the way things are. See if you can identify within yourself the conditioned pattern that reinforces that view again and again and tries to hold that view in place, applying it from one situation to the next, to the next. A little wisdom from Benjamin Franklin, who at the age of 82 said, "The older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment, even on matters that I was once certain of, because when I received fuller information or new arguments, I found that I was often wrong in the opinions that I originally formed." Take, for example, your views about meditation practice. What makes a practice a good practice? Some people have different views regarding emotions in practice. How do you relate to emotions when they arise? Is it a sign of good practice, deep purification? Something's really happening. You're getting in touch with those deep feelings and they're unfolding and you're feeling alive in the meditation practice. Is this a sign of good practice? Or is it a sign of bad practice? Not enough equanimity. Mind is all over the place, indulging in feelings, unsettled. I've had students come to interviews on meditation retreats, and one after another describe fairly similar actual experiences, but have completely different interpretations and views about them. So the example of the emotions, I've had one student come and say, describe an emotion, a feeling, and it's, my practice is just falling apart, I'm having this emotion, no equanimity. And then the next person comes, describes almost the same emotion. My practice is so deep, I'm getting in touch with these different layers. Which is right? Which is correct? Similarly, there can be a lot of different views about concentration practice. And many of you who practiced with me in the past know that I have for a number of years emphasized the cultivation of concentration, of samadhi and jhana in the development of meditation. And this can be controversial. Some people say that deep samadhi, deep concentration, even to the level of the absorption states of jhana, is absolutely necessary for liberating insight. And so they devote a great deal of time in the training to cultivating just concentration. Now, other people will say, concentration, it's not that important. Go directly for insight. You know, just contemplate, just inquire, just see things as they are. Cultivate mindfulness that is continuously moving to different experiences. And they will sometimes get into arguments about what is the appropriate place for concentration in the practice. What is the appropriate basis for insight? There can also be arguments in the tradition about the relative importance or unimportance of teachings on karma and rebirth. I've heard some teachers say, to argue to teachers that you are doing a disservice to the Dhamma, and in fact destroying the potential for the Dharma to take root in the West, watering it down if you don't emphasize the teachings of karma and rebirth. And I've heard other people argue the exact opposite, that karma and rebirth are unimportant in the Buddhist tradition, that was just a cultural artifact that can from ancient India that can be set aside, and that an alive, dynamic, contemporary, secular approach to the Dharma is what is needed. Let those thoughts of those ideas of rebirth and karma fall away, or else the Dhamma will not take root in the West. So both sides will be wishing for the Dharma to take root in the West, but have a very different argument about this issue of karma and rebirth. I've heard similar descriptions of enlightenment. Should we speak of enlightenment or not? To what extent? And even the discussion of the precepts, which to me seems like one of the most basic and fundamental parts of the practice. I can't imagine teaching without teaching the precepts. Some people will say, oh, no, no, don't teach the precepts, because then people will think you're telling them what they should do, and then they will rebel. So let's just teach mindfulness and wisdom, and trust that when the wisdom develops, enough precepts will come along, enough virtue will come along that will hold it. So even regarding the place for the precepts, there is some argument. And regarding metta, how is metta conceived? Some people have a view that metta is a primary practice, or an insight practice, or a liberating practice. And other people have the view, no, metta cannot be a liberating practice. It is simply a support for the heart, a purification of ill will, and an object suitable for concentration. With all these different views, you wonder, what are we practicing and how do we know what's right? We care so deeply about the Dhamma practice, about this path, and about the possibility of awakening and cultivating our minds, that it's natural that we might form some opinions and some views about it. Because we care so much, we become attached to a way of seeing, a way of being. Something is inspiring to us, and so we grab a hold of it. Something helps us in our practice, and so we become attached to that approach. So many sectarian conflicts have developed in the Buddhist tradition, just like every other religious tradition, simply because there were different approaches that served different people. And Mu Sung, who's a director and scholar at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, said, "What would it be like if we could train ourselves to softly note, this is the deluded mind at work, each time an opinion formed in our minds?" Isn't that a good suggestion? Every time an opinion forms, to remind ourselves, ah, this is the deluded mind. Let's see this. We recognize that the opinion has formed, but we recognize it as a manifestation of delusion. Many times when students ask to see me for individual interviews, they have already decided what is good and what is bad in their practice. Sometimes I don't know why they wanted to meet with me, because they had already decided. And so they come to the interview and they say, oh, my practice is so good, this has been happening. Or, oh, my practice is so bad, because this has been happening. And the interpretation and the opinion is really what is predominant in the minds. Can we let go of the interpretations and the opinions about our practice and try to see it more simply, more objectively? I've practiced in a couple of Burmese approaches to practice, where one goes to the teacher and has a very simple, bare bones report of exactly what we observed in our meditation practice. And it's a very matter-of-fact reporting style, just what we perceive. But this can be very challenging for people, not only because it requires a precise attention to detail, but because it discourages a personalized interpretation of perceptions. We might say something like, I noticed the rising, and I noted it as rising, and I noticed the falling of the abdomen, and I noted it as falling. On the rising, I noticed pressure that increased, and I noted pressure 4 times. There was a quick stopping and starting of tingling, and the heat increased, and just like matter-of-factly saying what we noticed moment by moment. Now, I've been practicing with this current teacher for the last 6 years, Venerable Pauk Sayadaw, and he does not systematize the reporting style. It's just, you know, you get to the point, you say what it was that you, you walk in, you bow, and then you report whatever's going on in your meditation, which is basically, how are you seeing the meditation object? How are you knowing the meditation object? And what's the relationship to that meditation object? But many people complicate their interviews by trying to use the interview time instead of to describe the meditation practice to basically interpret who they are through the meditation practice. And so they describe this and that, and I've overheard so many interviews where the student is actually derailing or disturbing their own progress simply by the way they are describing their practice, because in the very description they're reinforcing an opinion about their practice. They're in a way closing their mind and using the interview to seek a kind of affirmation of our position, of our histories, of our tendencies, of who we are, reinforcing a place for ourselves in the spiritual life. When we just describe what's happening moment to moment, we don't give very much place for the self to arise. It's a very impersonal, objective description. And it helps to take the story out of our experience. Because in the absence, then, of interpretations, of stories, of opinions, of comparisons, there's no fuel for self-construction to arise. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha described sources of conflict. And he said that householders easily lust, dispute around lust for sensual pleasures. Meaning, you know, we want this, we want that, and so we fight over it. Who gets it? Now, ascetics, he said, often dispute and fight over their attachment to views. And he said, the awakened ones have overcome both attachment to sensual pleasures and to views. Honestly, I think we fight over both. We dispute over both views and sensual pleasures. But this attachment to views is deeply ingrained. It's deeply ingrained because we often turn to our opinions and our views to have a sense of personal or social identity, a sense of belonging, or a way of defining ourselves, either by belonging to a group or being distinct from another group. And it can be very threatening to be confronted with a different view or a different opinion. But as intelligent people, educated people, we all know that views are impermanent, right? They're fragmentary. They don't really describe experience, just a certain perspective on it. And as new information comes to light, we might be willing to alter that view. And so I think most of us don't attach to views as everlasting, unchanging, God-given, absolute truth. We're a little too sophisticated for that. But in the formation of any opinion, we have identified with a perspective and created a platform upon which we build a self-identity. And in that progression from the raw sensory experience to the construction of an opinion, limited concepts of self arise. If we adopt a view, any view, it's as though we take birth, we incarnate through that attachment to that perspective. So any view becomes a trap, even spiritual views. Vipassana practitioners have the danger of becoming the one who sees impermanence, the one who observes change, or the one who has an insight into emptiness. A great Indian philosopher and practitioner, Nagarjuna, said, "Believers in emptiness are incurable." Mindfulness meditation trains us to observe the mind, to drop below and go deeper than the superficial concepts and constructs and opinions and views we have of things, but to look at the mind at a subtle level. When we explore that attachment, that clinging, we're not just looking at attachment to things in the world. More fundamental, when we're attached to anything in the world, we're really attached to a self position that is interpreting that relationship to a thing. We're building up a sense of self again and again. This is a primary view, the personality view, the view of who we are. In the traditional model of the five aggregates of mind and matter, all the aspects of materiality and mentality that are affected by clinging, we look at how materiality, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, when these aspects of mind and matter are affected by clinging, how do they give rise to a personal identity? How do they create a personalized perspective on experience? The Buddha listed four kinds of clinging that keep us trapped. I gave a talk on this in the last 10-day retreat about clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views and opinions, clinging to rites, rituals, conventions, and methods, and clinging to the concept of self. Now, most of these basically are about some form of wrong view. You know, whether we're attached to a view or an opinion in the mind, or a way of doing things, a rite or a ritual, or a concept of self, we're really attached to a certain perspective or way of doing, a way of seeing things. This grasping is a very internal process. I use the image of the parrot trap, where in ancient India they would create this way of catching parrots that had a wheel, a ring, that the farmer would place the ring in the field, and the parrot would come and land on the ring. And due to the weight of the parrot and the way that the parrot grabbed a hold of the ring would start to move, and it would start to circle, and the parrot would cling tighter and hold tighter to it as it continued to move. So it was basically trapped, not by a cage outside, it was trapped by the force of its own grasping. It held itself in its trap. And this is very much what we all do. We entrap ourselves by our views and our attachments to our views and our attachments to our opinions. When we understand how self forms through attachment, the body, the mind, the perceptions are all seen clearly. They're seen as being empty of self, not I, not me, not mine, just nature. They're still seen clearly. We see very clearly the functioning, the manifestation of matter and mind as nature, as it actually is. This is seeing with wisdom or right view, and it is liberating. It is not a good Buddhist view, a belief, that is going to free us from ignorance and attachment, which are the causes of suffering. It is the clarity of our perception to see things free from wrong view. So I don't want you to get the opinion, the impression that a spiritual practice is about developing a very clear and correct Buddhist view, nor is it devoid of opinions. We shouldn't be wishy-washy, inarticulate, indifferent navel gazers. You know, that's sometimes how Buddhists are criticized. There are times when we have to speak strongly, when we have to take a stance, when we have to say how we see things, what our perspective is. We have to take a stand on important issues about the Dhamma, important issues about our lives, important issues in our communities and in our nations. We need to be able to express our views, to express our opinions, but it's important to know that an opinion is an opinion, and a view is a view. There, at the time of the Buddha, there was a standard set of philosophical views that were commonly debated. Is the world eternal or not eternal? Is the world infinite or not infinite, finite? Does the Buddha exist after death or not exist after death? Is the soul the same as the body or not the same as the body? After all these various viewpoints are stated in one discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, Ananda is listening. And the ascetics of different orders and different practices all describe which viewpoint they take, and they take a stance. And Ananda is, then they turn to Ananda and ask him what view is the Buddhist view. And he does not take a position. He does not agree or disagree with any of them. But he also doesn't say that he doesn't know. He instead shifts the discussion from the speculation, the content of the discussion, the speculation that was going on, to the very process that he was observing of how views were being established and how views were being treated. It's the current process, the present moment process, that he commented on. And he said, only this is true. Anything else is worthless, is a viewpoint. The extent to which there are viewpoints, view stances, the taking up of views, obsession with views, the cause of views, and the uprooting of views, that's what I know. That's what I see. Knowing that, I say I know. Seeing that, I say I see. Why should I say I don't know? I do see. I do know. I do see. He states what he is actually perceiving. And that perception includes the tendency of that discussion to revolve around attachment to views and opinions. Can we sometimes not get pulled into the arguments and instead take a step back and see the process? What is that arguing serving? How is it creating stances upon which people can become attached, create their groups, their identities, their identifications, and thereby create conflict? How is the construction of views and opinions causing suffering? In the Buddhist tradition, wrong view, or not seeing how mind and matter function, or how attachment leads to suffering, is the basic supporting factor of ignorance. For the Noble Eightfold Path to be established, wrong view must be abandoned. This is the very first step. But then when right view arises, right view is not a particular view. Right view is considered to be beyond attachment to any view. It's not a more correct or accurate view of reality. It's an ending of the attachments to misperceptions. So I'm not encouraging you on this weekend to refine the accuracy of your opinions. I hope you don't leave with a better view or a more polished spiritual opinion. Any view affected by clinging is inherently a wrong view. The Buddha repeatedly encouraged his disciples to avoid arguments, to avoid disputes regarding any philosophical position, and instead to inquire into the core questions, the questions that have the potential to free the mind from attachment, to question what is suffering and what is the end of suffering. Many of you will know the story of the Buddha walking through a forest one day with a group of his monks. And he looked up at the forest, the leaves in the forest, and said that his knowledge was as vast as the leaves on the trees in the whole forest. And then he reached down and picked up a handful of leaves. And he said, "But what I teach is like the handful of leaves. I teach suffering and the end of suffering, because this is beneficial." To repeat a verse from the Middle Link Discourses, if a person has a belief, he preserves truth when he says, "My belief is thus." He does not yet come to the definite conclusion, "Only this is true, anything else is wrong." I would like to take the last minutes of this session to sit quietly and to reflect on a few questions that I'll pose in the silence of these moments of sitting. If anything strikes you in your reflections as being useful, at the end of the sitting, you might want to jot just a note or two down so that you can remember it and perhaps reflect more later. You might think of a time recently when you were speaking and expressing a view or an opinion. Please consider, what was that particular opinion based upon? Did it develop out of your personal experience? Was it supported by the words of somebody else, somebody that you know or respect? Was it in line with any particular social or political groups or associations that you feel you belong to? Was it supported by any kind of philosophical perspective? By information you gained from the media? So when we have a view, I'm asking you to look at how you support it within your own minds and how it serves you. Would you be willing to change that opinion? Can you imagine a situation in which you would alter that opinion? Another way of seeing it, another perspective. When you consider your own way of engaging with views and opinions in your life, do you consider yourself somebody who can easily listen to views and opinions that disagree with your own? Do you accept those as valid? And then considering your own meditation practice, your Dharma practice, your relationship to insight, to awakening, to the spiritual life, Do you judge your progress? Do you hold opinions about where you are on the path? Are they critical opinions? Or are they opinions based on pride? Imagine letting go of the opinions, letting go of the attachment to the views. What might you be left with? What might your experience be?